This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, is your job affecting your health? Has your professional stress level gone way up or way down since the pandemic hit? We'll talk to an IU researcher about a new study on the topic, and Indiana researchers have wrapped up testing on a pre-existing antimicrobial fabric that proves its effectiveness against coronaviruses, which could mean big things for PPE, especially face masks. But first, our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman is here to fill us in on the week's news. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. So let's start by looking at the COVID-19 numbers. We hit a new milestone this week.
Yes, we did. So as of noon today, 2,078 people have died from COVID-19 in Indiana. There are more than 36,000 confirmed cases and more than 291,000 Hoosiers who have been tested. So to compare that to 2 weeks ago, we had 1,791 people who had died. And then there were more than 30,000 confirmed cases and more than 208,000 Hoosiers who had been tested. So over the course of 2 weeks, we've seen about 90,000 Hoosiers tested. But that also means that this week we hit 2,000 deaths reported over the course of 4 weeks.
4 weeks or 4 months?
So 2,000 deaths reported since the beginning of all of this, but the second half of that, the most recent 1,000 deaths, we hit 1,000 deaths before the day before the governor announced his back on track plan. Mm. And 1 month into that plan, we hit the additional 2,000 1,000.
Right.
Yeah. But there is a big caveat to that. Because of the delay in reporting deaths, it's kind of hard for us to draw conclusions from the data as it's released. And that was something that State Health Commissioner Chris Box mentioned when I asked her about this particular milestone, because when you do look at the data based on when the person died, you do see a very distinct downward trend in the number of deaths that are actually happening. But as they're being reported, it is, you know, the 1,000 in one month.
Sure. And as we see the numbers every day, I mean, it's a daily comparison, of course. But when we pull back, does it look like, and we haven't done this in a few weeks, does it look like it's going down, like everything's going down, the number of cases, the number of deaths? Do you have that information?
Yeah, the number of deaths, definitely. There's a very, very distinct curve that you can see. Again, the other caveat to that, though, is that there is such a delay in reporting deaths. So the data that I'm looking at from the State Department of Health shows that the highest, most recent day of deaths, is from mid-May. But the highest toll bill was 37 people who died on that day. That being said, there are still people from the day before that who are being reported as having died. So there's the delays in the data almost make it kind of impossible to even do that kind of retrospective look back. As far as positive cases go, that graph is a little bit more squishy. The data itself looks a little bit funkier. So, you know, again, we don't really know, especially with the delays in reporting to the State Department of Health.
Mm. Let's get to the big story this week, and that was the protests that have rocked the nation and, of course, Indiana in several places. And you were there covering a lot of the protests in Indianapolis.
Yeah, I spent the vast majority of my weekend covering protests, shooting photos and video to kind of help support the audio reporters who are covering, like Eric Weddle, like Jill Sheridan. And those protests have continued throughout the rest of the week as well. Indianapolis has continued to have protests every single day without the same kind of police confrontation that we saw over the weekend. Muncie had one yesterday. South Bend has one tonight. I believe Fort Wayne also has one tonight. So there's those protests are still continuing to happen, definitely.
And so it looks like in South Bend there's been a development.
Yeah, I mean, there are specific goals for each of these protests, right? And South Bend's protests over the last weekend were did not have a police presence in the same way that Indianapolis did, and certainly not in the same way that Fort Wayne did either. And one of the reasons for that, from activists, we had a conversation on Wednesday on our Facebook Live with organizers who basically said, look, we've been doing this. We've been organizing since Eric Logan's death, a man who was shot and killed by South Bend police, and kind of his death rose to prominence because of former Democratic presidential candidate and former mayor Pete Buttigieg. In South Bend, they're really focused on making their community better, not just because of the specifics around Eric Logan's death, but also specifics around community policing, which includes the creation of a civilian review board and the Board of Public Safety adopting an intercultural development inventory that, you know, it's not a test that tells you if someone's racist, but it highlights lack of cultural competency and really taking a hard look as to who are making up your police officers. If your officers are all people who don't live within the city and don't interact with the people in the city, is that representative of the people that they're supposed to be protecting? And activists say that not only are they not indicative or not representative of the people that they're supposed to be protecting, but that they do not have a place on that police department then, because they aren't a part of that community.
So we're hearing the name Eric Logan a lot in South Bend at the protests. And there's a name that's being said in Indianapolis a lot at the protests. And this was a fairly recent event. What are people saying about Sean Reed?
Yeah, Drayshawn Reed. I realized only Wednesday night that Drayshawn Reed's death was in May. I thought that was 100 years ago.
Seems like it.
Yeah. Drayshawn Reed was shot and killed by IMPD officers after live streaming the tail end of a police chase. So protesters in Indianapolis have really focused on him. He died on the same day that two others were killed by IMPD officers as a result of IMPD officers. One woman, a pregnant woman, was struck while walking on an interstate highway ramp. Activists in Indianapolis are looking for very specific, tangible things to be done surrounding Drayshawn Reed. So they want the name of the officer who shot and killed him. They want that officer fired, and they want that officer to be charged to face charges for that act. And that's also involved a special prosecutor. So 2 days after Reed's killing, Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears asked a court to appoint a special prosecutor to probe the shooting. Mears said that Police Chief Randall Taylor's role in as a material witness constitutes a conflict of interest and immediately wanted to get somebody else in there. And the special prosecutor was only announced yesterday. So there's a lot of that going on specifically around Drayshawn Reed. But organizers in Indianapolis are also very much in the same vein as South Bend, looking to reform parts of their community, including, for example, citizens on a use of force board. Mayor Joe Hogsett has promised this use of force board since 2018. But organizers have concerns about what it looks like. It's designed to replace a firearm review board, which was criticized for failing to investigate 19 officer-involved shootings, including 6 deaths. And then even outside of that, both Indianapolis and South Bend Black Lives Matter organizers are working for housing justice, food insecurity, things along those lines. So there's definitely more to these protests than the police confrontations and the officer-involved shootings. It's also about a more holistic look about how Black Hoosiers are being treated in this state.
Thanks for your coverage on this, and of course for your help last weekend with photos and in coverage downtown Indianapolis. Let's move on to the primary election, which was held this week, and kind of surprising results on school referenda or referendums, whichever you prefer.
I prefer referenda.
To each their own.
So unofficial results show 16 out of 18 school funding referenda measure. Jeannie wrote this, referendum measures passed. So we're not going to know official results until next week. But it's the state's biggest group of referenda all at once since 2010. And as of Wednesday morning, it looks like it will be the most successful. The one big thing to note about the one of the two failures or failures, things that did not pass, was voters rejected the state's second ever safety referenda for New Albany Floyd County schools. And so, yeah, those are the big things for school referenda. Again, we'll know more about what that all shakes out to look like probably next week.
Okay. And there were not very many, depending on where you were, there were not very many big elections on or big races, I guess, for the primary this year. Now, that is with the exception of the 1st and the 5th districts. What did we find there?
Yeah. And the caveat being that those are for statewide candidates. Certainly your local and down ballot elections were super important. But in the 1st, Frank Mervan, North Township trustee and son of longtime state senator Frank Mervan, will face Republican Mark Leyva. Leyva challenged outgoing Democrat U.S. Representative Pete Vislosky 7 times and did not defeat him. And then in the 5th, U.S. Representative Susan Burke's retirement announcement leaves State Senator Victoria Spartz with a Republican nomination and former State Representative Christina Hale with the Democratic nomination. And there were 15 Republicans that were competed for that district nomination and 5 Democrats.
She is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and she's been busy this week out covering the protests in Indianapolis. Lauren, as always, we'll talk to you next week, and thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, are you free to do your job how you want to, or is your day mapped out by your boss? New research from the IU Kelley School of Business shows employee autonomy is a key factor in job stress. We're back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelzer. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. If you've ever wondered if your job is killing you, well, there may be some empirical truth to that. A new study from the Indiana University Kelley School of Business points to major factors that lead to stress at the workplace and the deteriorating effects that stress can have on your health. And if stress in the workplace was already taking its toll, a pandemic hasn't ushered in much relief. So, where can we pinpoint these contributors to stress, and how can we work to reduce them? Joining us now to tell us more about the study and how to mitigate those stressors is Assistant Professor of Organizational Behavior and Human Resources at the Kelley School, Eric Gonzalez-Mule. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Matt. Thanks so much for having me on.
So this study is titled, in part, "This Job is Literally Killing Me," end quote. And I can only imagine how many people resonate with that statement, especially under the circumstances we find ourselves in right now. So let's start with what got you interested in this topic. What started in on this question?
Yeah. So, I mean, really, the thing that really got me interested in it was just a morbid fascination, essentially, of what you know, what is it about work that can lead to deteriorations in our health and ultimately to death? And so this particular study is a follow-up from one that we did 3 years ago, where we were examining how it is that job demands, or you know, we can think of those as very broadly as stressors at work. So things having to do with how much time pressure you have, concentration demands at work, and the workload, how it is that those factors impact death, and how it is that the amount of control you have at your jobs, you can think of that as your autonomy. So your decision-making freedom, the ability you have to plan your own work, to decide how and when to do your work, how it is that those two factors interact to predict death. And in that first study 3 years ago, we found that those in more stressful jobs that have a high degree of control are less likely to die than those that have stressful jobs with a low degree of control. So we found that control is almost like the switch that makes stressors at work be harmful versus not.
Do you have examples of a job where the stress level is high, but you still have a degree of control, versus examples of a job where, again, the stress level is high, where the control is very low for the employee?
Yeah. So on the former, you can really think of a professor, right? So a professor has a pretty, you know, a lot of work to do. So we have to get our research done. We have to, you know, we have certain goals for publications that we need to meet every year. We have to teach our classes. There's a lot of work involved in the preparation for that and in the execution. But at the same time, we have a lot of autonomy over how it is that we go about doing that. So besides me being physically in my classroom at the time that my class is scheduled, I could really be anywhere doing anything. And my boss doesn't really care, as long as at the end of the year, I've got, you know, good publication records and things to show for it. And so, but on the other side, so those with the stressful work with not a lot of control, you can think of like a call center employee. So call center employees have a lot of workload. They're jumping from one call to the next. There's a time pressure. You know, usually have performance metrics that have to do with how much time they're on the call and whether they resolve customers' problems. But then they don't have a lot of autonomy over how they go about doing that. Right? There's usually pretty rigid company policies that they have to follow and execute, and they have to. You know, there's not a lot of the ability to participate in goal setting or anything like that in those kinds of jobs.
I also think of, and maybe I'm off base here because I didn't conduct the study, but I'm just wondering, would I don't know, something easy like doctors and lawyers be on that list as well? I would guess particularly doctors, because, you know, you're dealing with patients who are coming in and they're on their own time and you have to be on their time. And it's a very stressful work environment as well. Would something like that be on the list, or was that something that was considered?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think doctors are an interesting case, because you're right that, you know, being a doctor or a lawyer for that matter is a very stressful job. I mean, you know, some doctors will work, you know, 12, 14 hour days pretty commonly, especially if you're a surgeon or something. But doctors do have quite a bit of flexibility in terms of setting their own schedules. So, you know, doctors do have some leeway there, you know, where they can plan to have, you know, to build in vacation days into their schedule. They can, if they own their own practice, they very much control how many patients they see. So there's quite a bit of, I think, of autonomy and control in doctor's jobs. Of course, there's variability, right? So you can think of a doctor that's employed in a hospital practice where they're maybe don't have a lot of autonomy, and there's more hospital rules and things they have to follow. And I think with a lawyer, it's the same thing. You know, if you're a partner in a law firm, or if you have your own firm, you probably have quite a bit of flexibility. Whereas if you're someone just starting out, probably not so much flexibility while still having a great deal of stress.
And you point out that these stressors affect someone's physical health and their mental health differently. How is that?
Yeah, great question. So earlier today, or earlier in our conversation, I mean, I was talking about the earlier study we did. And then this was really the contribution of this new study, is we were interested in explaining why. So why does work stress lead to death? And so this new study tries to answer that question by examining mental health, which we measure just using a clinical depression scale. So you can think of it as whether people are depressed or not. And physical health we measured using a series of biomarkers. So you can think of those as being like biological indicators of someone's health. So things like the cholesterol levels, triglycerides, blood pressure. So that's an established medical measure that we used and combined into an overall measure of health. And essentially what we found is that the same pattern from the earlier study really replicates in the case of mental health, in the sense that people that have stressful work and that have a high degree of control are largely insulated by the mental health consequences of stress. However, those that have high stress and low control actually have a much higher chance of being depressed and ultimately of dying. And in this study, we also examined cognitive ability. So you can think of that as people's general intelligence, so their ability to think, you know, abstractly solve problems and learn. And we found that people's intelligence has a very similar effect to control, in that those that have high intelligence are also buffered from those stressful effects at work, whereas those with lower intelligence suffer much more on the mental health side. And we think that that's because smarter people are probably just better able to, you know, think about the way that they're going to approach their work, to plan their work, to, you know, prioritize work tasks. You can think of them as almost like crafting the work to be less stressful for them, even if there is an objectively high amount of work and things they have to do.
Work smarter, so that, not harder.
Exactly. That's a great way of thinking about it. Yes. And so that's all on the mental health side. The physical health side threw us a little bit for a loop, in that cognitive ability didn't have any effect there. And we found that with control, it actually makes stressful work be better for your physical health. And so it's not just the fact that it's not harmful, it's actually better. So being in a stressful job with a high degree of autonomy, in our study at least, was better for physical health. And we think that what might be going on there is that people in stressful jobs that have a high degree of autonomy are still able to kind of make the work fit a lifestyle that kind of engenders itself to better physical health. So imagine someone that can take a 1 hour break in the middle of the day to go walk their dog, you know, because they're working from home, you know, or somebody that can plan time to go to the gym in the morning before they start work, you know. So people that have more flexibility with their job are better able to work things like that in. And then the stress aspect has to do really with the sense of fulfillment and mastery that people get when they're able to accomplish a difficult job task. So those people that are in really stressful jobs that have a high degree of control probably get these dual benefits of being able to structure their days in ways that are better for their physical health, while also being able to kind of enjoy those experiences of fulfillment and accomplishment that come from, accomplishing a difficult work task.
We're talking with Assistant Professor of Organizational Behavior and Human Resources at the IU Kelly School of Business, Eric Gonzalez-Mule, who is the co-author of This Job Is Literally Killing Me, A Moderated Mediated Model Linking Work Characteristics to Mortality. So, Eric, can you talk about how this study was designed and I guess what kind of data overall you were collecting and analyzing? You mentioned some of it just a second ago, but let's get a bigger picture. Let's get a little more comprehensive.
Sure. So the data for this study were actually collected by a group out of the University of Wisconsin who, within a partnership with the National Institute of Aging, conduct this survey where they have a group of participants that they follow up with every 10 years, and they ask them various questions about their work, about their lives. And in the time period that we conducted the study, we also have those physical measurements that I mentioned earlier and that depression scale. So the way that our study was conducted was in the mid-90s, when these folks were in their early 40s. So the average age was about 42. They had to respond to questions about their work. So there we have questions about job demands and job control. We also collected quite a bit of demographic information. So we, in all the statistical models, we controlled for age, race, sex. We controlled for some personality traits that have been shown to be linked to depression, like positive and negative affect. And so that was at that time, one period in 1995. Approximately 10 years later, then they followed up with the participants and collected data on depression and on the physical health measure. And then about 10 years after that, they followed up and collected data on who had died. So we have 10 years in between kind of each step of the study, which allows us to link those indirect effects of being stressed at work to the likelihood of dying some 20 years later.
Huh. And so knowing what we know from this paper, what do you recommend to employers if they're looking to create conditions for employees that allow them to be successful and productive while keeping stress at a healthy level?
Yeah, so the number one suggestion that we make to employers is to introduce autonomy, so some degree of control. So what we really found is that there isn't like it's not like it's an all or nothing proposition. So it doesn't have to be, you don't have to give people an extreme amount of control to get any benefits. So even something small, like allowing employees to participate in goal setting, is something you can do to increase control. You know, kind of on the more extreme end, you could allow people to work from home at least part of the time. You know, people tend in general to like that, and people tend to perform better in those circumstances. And that's one way to give people control so they can structure their workday the way that they see fit at, you know, something that's better for them that fits their lifestyle. You know, for myself, I have two small children, so I find myself taking lots of breaks during the day to hang out with them, but then I'm working at night when they're asleep, you know, and if I was in a kind of a typical 9-to-5 environment, I wouldn't be able to do that. And so that's one thing you can do. So participate, allow employees to participate in goal setting, introduce some work from home policies, telecommuting type work. You can even allow employees to have flex time. So essentially choosing when it is that they want to work and allowing them to make schedules that fit their own schedule. You know, and you can think of these as kind of being on a continuum of control, right? With where flex time or participating in goal setting is kind of a lower form of giving employees control. Working from home is kind of a more radical solution. And on the other hand, on the cognitive ability side that we were talking about earlier, you know, the most important thing for employers is to select employees for stressful, demanding jobs that have the aptitude to do it. So, you know, many employers use, for example, the Wunderlich test to select employees, or at least in part or some derivative thereof, as a kind of an early screening tool. And so what our study suggests is that beyond just being an early screening tool, it actually can help you assign employees to work that better fits their capabilities.
So in a way, and correct me if I'm wrong here, and I know you, I, at least I think you didn't look at the pandemic specifically. In a way, for some, under certain circumstances, the pandemic has maybe lowered their stress level because they're able to work from home?
Yeah, that's a great question, Matt. And so this is one that I've thought about quite a bit and discussed with my co-author as well, because there's competing things going on here. So on the one hand, you're absolutely right. So more people are getting to work from home. So on the one hand, we're thinking, okay, well, that's great. You know, people have a lot of autonomy. They're able to structure their work in a way that is better for them. On the other hand, people are being thrust into that. And it's not something like, for example, they took a job knowing they'd be working from home. So there might be some people that have never worked from home before or are uncomfortable with doing so, or that don't have childcare. So working from home could actually become a very stressful thing when you've got kids and you basically have nothing to do with them. So it gets difficult to do your work. So, you know, and so you're right. Our study was conducted well before the pandemic. And so it'll be, you know, it's a question for future research to see what it is that these work, you know, kind of, you can almost think of it as work from home that people aren't choosing, how that might impact people.
Indeed. And again, it's circumstantial. If you have been stressed out because of the pandemic, you are certainly not alone. And so let's talk about this balance of productivity and keeping a healthy stress level. Are there examples of companies or practices, I guess, that you see striking this balance well?
Yeah. So a really good kind of prototypical example is Google, in that Google gives employees the famous Google 20% time that has become quite popular in the high tech industry, where you allow employees one day of the week to work on whatever it is that they want. So they have their regularly assigned projects, their regular meetings, their regular tasks that they have to do Monday through Thursday. But then on Friday, they get to just work on something else. So something that they just find intrinsically motivating and satisfying. And so Google's done that to great effect. And I think that they do a pretty good job of managing employee well-being.
Now, so let's say you're working for a company where there really isn't that sort of autonomy built into the structure of the company. So if there's not specific action or programs on the part of the employer, do you have any advice for individual actions that employees can take to bring those stress levels down?
Yeah. So, you know, you're absolutely right that there's some jobs that the suggestions I'm making are just impossible, right? So you can think of somebody that has to follow a really prescribed set of rules to get their job done, or the employer has to have people there for a certain number of hours every day. So for people like that, you know, the folks that are in jobs that just don't engender themselves to control, what we recommend is that they find some way to craft their job for themselves. So, but what I mean by that is reframing the mindset with which you approach work. So people that, for example, if you're a grocery store clerk, instead of thinking of yourself as just kind of scanning items every day, you should think of yourself as helping people feed their families or helping people get the food that they need. And by having this kind of pro-social reorientation of your work, we found that can, research by other colleagues of ours have found that could really help improve your perceptions of stress, and it can also make you more productive and happier at work. And that's to say, it's not a substitute, right, for being able to have more autonomy at work, but it's just something that can help you cope with the stressors, especially, in the age of COVID, where everybody's more stressed and dealing with, we have increases in mental health issues and the like. So those kinds of reframing and reorienting techniques can help reduce stress.
What do you think still needs further research around this topic? Are there aspects you still have questions about?
Yeah, there are. So one of the big things is how different stressors affect people. So we know that there's different types of stressors. So these are largely delineated in terms of whether stressors are challenges or hindrances. So challenge stressors are kind of what we measured in this study. So you can think of those, like I mentioned earlier, time pressure, workload, concentration demands. So they're things that are stressful because they make us anxious, right? Because we have a lot of work to do and we have a certain amount of time to do it. But it's stress that can also be motivating. You know, if you're able to accomplish those tasks, it could be, it makes you feel good when you do something that's difficult, on the other hand, hindrances are things like organizational bureaucracy and red tape and the like. And there hasn't been a lot of work seeing if those two have different effects on mortality. So we know from some preliminary studies that have been done that hindrances are much more strongly related to burnout than challenge stressors are. But we don't know if those effects extend out, to kind of hard medical outcomes over time. So that's something that my co-authors and I are going to be looking at and potentially exploring in the next year or so.
Assistant Professor of Organizational Behavior and Human Resources at the Indiana University Kelly School of Business, Eric Gonzalez-Mule. It was great to have you with us today. Thanks for taking the time.
Likewise. My pleasure, Matt. Thank you so much.
Up next, another study out of IU could mean big things in the fight against COVID-19, and the technology is so groundbreaking, it's over the heads of even the regulators approving it. I'm Matt Pelser, back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The COVID-19 pandemic has refocused a great deal of medical device research around the world, and one recent development out of Indiana University has shown that a certain kind of fabric already in use in the medical realm for other purposes could greatly improve the effectiveness of certain PPE, namely face masks. It is dizzyingly fascinating technology, and we have with us the principal author of the study that looked closely at this fabric and its properties. Chandan Sen is director of the Indiana Center for Regenerative Medicine and Engineering at the IU School of Medicine. Dr. Sen, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So to start, in reading about this, I learned a new word, electroceutical. What does that mean?
Electroceutical means the use of certain electrical forces, be it electric field, electrostatic forces, for therapeutic purposes to improve health outcomes. Electroceuticals have been used for, say, nerve stimulation. The pacemaker uses electricity and pulses to keep the heart going. But now that field is growing, and what we're talking here is about applying electroceuticals for the management of infection.
So in this case, we're talking about electroceutical fabric. How do you achieve this? Or how is this achieved? I know you didn't make it, but how is this done?
So the one can make electroceutical fabric in principle by a number of ways. There are very advanced materials these days, including conducting polymers. But in this particular case, we have two versions of the fabric. In one version, it has battery. In the other version, it doesn't. And the one that actually makes the mask in this case does not have the battery. It's a very simple format where silver and zinc metal is printed onto the fabric in a way that your fingers cannot feel it. You would just feel the textile as any other textile, except that you would see some very tiny looking polka dots, if you will. And they are spaced in a particular way such that upon contact with bodily fluids or other aqueous, a substance containing electrolytes, a certain amount of electrochemistry is turned on and you generate electric field.
And so what is happening there? So this kind of creates an antiseptic almost. I guess I'm grasping for the right word here. What does this do?
The fabric itself was originally designed for being a wound dressing. And in this particular case, we have already published recently in the in a top journal in the discipline of surgery called Annals of Surgery, that you can manage bacterial biofilm infection using this fabric. So bacteria can exist in a planktonic form, such as swimming around in liquid, or they could form aggregates and spin certain amount of cement-like substance around them. And in that format, the biofilm format, which is an aggregate format, it's very difficult to kill those bacteria because they are not so accessible by the immune cells of the body, and also they are not so accessible by the antibiotics we apply. So we were successful in eradicating those biofilm infection using this electroceutical fabric, and that was the primary purpose of developing this fabric.
So I guess, how is it working? What is it doing to the bacteria, or in this case, the viruses, to, I guess, neutralize? I mean, is it killing them?
So first, let me give you the example of an extreme example. You would know that there are bacteria that humans use to generate electricity. So biophysical properties of bacteria or microbes that generate electrical forces is not unknown, and they do so by the movement of certain types of ions, charged ions that move and resulting in the formation of these types of electrical signals. Now it is well established that the bacterial community, if you will, talk to each other, if you can think of a social networking of bacteria using electrical signals. Now, if you get in, furthermore, they actually use electrostatic forces in many cases to attach to the surface they want to infect. So there are multiple mechanistic approaches by which bacteria utilize these types of properties to execute or implement their pathogenic properties. So what you do is you go in and you disrupt that homeostasis or that environment that is favorable for the bacteria to thrive.
So it's almost like you're jamming their communication signal?
In the case of the bacterial biofilm, that is exactly the case. And then later on, when you jam them, what happens is you isolate them. They cannot form successful aggregates. And now that they cannot form successful aggregates, now you're making them more accessible by the immune cells, by the antibiotics. So taken together, you eradicate them.
Okay. And so walk me through this. I remember from biology that viruses are very different from something like bacteria or other single-celled organisms. So does the antimicrobial property of this fabric work in the same way against these viruses, coronaviruses, which again is a family of viruses, not just the one that we're all dealing with right now? So is it doing the same thing against the viruses, I guess, as it is against bacterium and bacteria?
Like you mentioned, the viruses are quite different from bacteria in that they do not replicate outside the host. So outside a host, we think of a virus as a particle. And because of its size, which is around, you know, if you talk about the coronavirus, it's about 100 nanometers. It can be viewed as a nanoparticle. And this particular nanoparticle, you know, of course, there are a few elements to it. We all know about it now because there's so much in the news. To make a very long story very short, you have the capsid and you have the single-stranded RNA. And if you examine the literature, one would find that this RNA is negatively charged and the capsid is positively charged. And there is an electrostatic force in play that helps the bacteria in attaching to the surface it wants to infect. And also, there are some papers that lead to the thought that it could also support the replication of the virus inside the host. Now, we are right now not talking about it because when you're talking about a virus particle attaching to a PPE, there is no host as of yet. So let's talk about the virus itself, the particle itself or the virion. In this particular case, if one takes these particles, which we did, and we measured the so-called zeta potential of the particle, the zeta potential describes the electrokinetic property of the particle. And we see that for the coronavirus we studied, it's about -25 to -30 millivolts. Now, as this number approaches zero, the stability of the particle gets lower. So what we saw is the moment we put it in the fabric, then when we retrieve those particles from the fabric and put it back into the equipment to measure, we see that it drops to, say, minus 15 millivolts or so. So the zeta potential is cut by half, which is in favor of destabilizing the particle. And also what one sees, as we have reported, is that the structure of the virus is, there's a big peak. So its size is 100 nanometers. You see a big peak in 100 nanometers. The moment you put in the fabric, what happens is that peak becomes small and it becomes a broad-based peak, meaning there is viral aggregation. So the time has been short. Everything we have been doing is in the last 4 to 6 weeks. But we are certain that there are structural changes happening, certainly happening. There are changes in the electrokinetic property of the virus happening. And associated with that, when you now take that particle and put it to a cell under ideal conditions of infection, it loses infectivity.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. And so how long has this electroceutical fabric or others like it been around and in use?
So, you know, we have two versions. I don't know of any other in the, you know, in the literature or in the market. There are two that, you know, one we have developed, the other we have co-developed. The one with this company that you currently see in Mask, we have been working on this for about, I'd say, 7 to 8 years now. And but at the time, it was not known that it would work in this way. So when the company came to me, we looked at this property and hypothesized this is how it could work. So then we actually went down this path, and there is those line of research. Right now, there are like six papers or so already published that look very promising. Now, the whole work on coronavirus was when we are asked to be in shelter in place, we have pretty much shut down our lab and went home and started looking at the coronavirus literature and looked at this biophysical property of the coronavirus, which we thought could be exploited to dismantle it. And so that's how it all came about.
How did this study make it to your desk? I mean, how did you and your team come to be the ones looking at this?
Well, you know, I am not a virologist. So, but anyway, I can read virology, I can understand. So once I read and I understood what I understood, I got in touch with a colleague who is a co-author on our paper, Professor Ken Cornetta, who is a serious virus scientist. And I said, hey, Ken, look, this is what we are thinking. What do you think? And he thought the idea was a great one. And I said, Ken, can you please do some experiments for us? And then he did some experiments. It turned out to be very promising. And then we picked up pace on that and we kept going. So before this whole coronavirus story unfolded, we had no idea that we would be working on viruses. Before that, we were working on bacteria, which we already have published. And more recently, we have a large amount of work that we just did on Candida albicans, which is yeast infection, as you know. And we also worked on another outbreak in yeast called Candida auris. And the results there were very promising. So we thought if it works in the bacteria, it works in the fungi, let's try it in this virus because the viral properties look quite amenable to this type of an approach.
Was that a big pivot for you? I mean, you know, going from working with bacteria to working with viruses, or is it just simply an easy change, I suppose?
No, it was not easy change. And frankly, what happened was that we were sitting home and, you know, frankly, personally speaking, I was feeling very guilty because I think the healthcare community, including myself, the scientist community, did not, you know, somehow failed the broader community in getting their back. You know, the larger world is in trouble and we have very little to do. That was making us all very uncomfortable. And that level of discomfort drove us to leave our area of comfort in science and explore additional avenues where we could make a small contribution. So we are certainly not a vaccine development lab, and those approaches are happening throughout the country and throughout the world, and we will have to wait and see how those go. But this was certainly within our means to do, and I knew professors around me who would be happy to help us out with their expertise. So we formed a team, and we went at it.
I feel like I'm hearing a lot of stories like that lately. Are you heartened by that, people flexing and pivoting their research and their roles in order to kind of all tackle this problem?
Very much so, very much so. And I think a very heartening development that then happened is when we jumped into this, you know, and the university, you know, development office contacted me and said, Dr. Sen, do you have all the funding you need? I said, look, this was not a budgeted project, but I'm going to do this anyway. But if there is any fund that we can get, that would be nice. And we had pretty much all of this project, funded by philanthropic gifts. People I know and people I don't know from around the community within Indiana. And I'm so grateful to them. Some of the faces I just don't even know, and so this is very moving and reassuring that, we as a community can be so resilient. So something I see that as a silver lining in this dark cloud that is hanging over us.
And so you being as close to this particular research, you feel pretty confident that this could be used effectively. This is an application that's going to be used if it's approved, in face masks, right?
Yeah, it could be used for pretty much any, PPEs, personal protective equipment. But I think the broader message here is this fabric is not the only way it can be delivered. Right now, it is productized and therefore it is readily available. And it is a solution, but I think what a new door has opened up in thinking that this new avenue. So now you're talking about not a drug, not pharmacology, but biophysics being used to treat health. So that's a very different, and I don't know of other such cases in the entire field of infection that people have been able to use electroceutical to manage infection. And I'm particularly excited about it because every so many years, we have a new generation antibiotic. And then after a while, we have antibiotic resistant microbes. And then we have another new generation. How long is this going to go up on? So we decided that why don't we try to break this cycle that doesn't seem to have an end and try to completely use another approach, which would be drug independent, and get to the bacteria and strike them from a biophysical angle. So this is, in principle, a very different way of managing infection. And I hope that this, through the participation of other scientists and thinkers, unfold itself into a discipline.
It's really thinking outside the box, for sure. And we are hearing an awful lot about face masks these days, homemade masks, surgical masks, the N95 masks. Is there anything else out there that comes close to the antimicrobial properties of this fabric that you looked at, that you know of?
No, so I think primarily this would be for masks and PPEs. As you also know, in the literature, there is a lot of evidence that hospital fabric is a source of infection. Hospital-acquired infection is a big problem, huge problem. And there, if we can utilize fabrics such as this, that would not be harboring pathogens from different types of patients that hang around in the hospital, and that would then provide security. So in a broader sense, you could actually use this principle to clean up air in a place where you expect to have a large number of viral particles suspended in air. You can use to clean up even rooms, not with this particular fabric I'm talking about, using the principle. As it comes to the fabric itself, hospital fabrics, would be another target, how to keep the hospital clean.
And we mentioned before that this fabric is already in use as a wound dressing, and so it already has FDA clearance. But since this is a new application, face masks versus wound dressings or whatever PPE they decide to use it in, does it require more study or approval, or can these masks, say their masks, go right into commercial production? How does that work?
No, because it is a different claim, it requires a new approval. And thankfully, FDA has an EUA, Emergency Use Authorization. Also, thankfully, this last Monday, I had a meeting with the FDA, a panelist and our group met with them. And they were asking, they have sent back a few more questions to be answered. And we were going to respond to them. And frankly speaking, even at the meeting with the FDA, it was not going across very smoothly that now microbes can be managed without an antimicrobial drug. Huh. So to communicate that message, so there, we were being asked, so where is the antimicrobial coating? There is no coating. It is the electric field. So this will not be so readily understood, and we have to make the effort to, through questions like what you are asking, make a logical, sort of sensible sort of argument that holds water, which can then pass. So a short answer to your question would be that this has to go through its own approval process, and we are sort of midway in that process.
How exciting that it's that groundbreaking that certain people can't quite grasp how it works. That is fascinating work. And Chandan Sen is the director of the Indiana Center for Regenerative Medicine and Engineering at the IU School of Medicine. Dr. Sen, thank you for your work and thanks for your time today.
Thank you for listening to me. Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. We are a Monday through Friday show, so if we're not on every day where you live, take a look at our podcast feed and make sure you didn't miss a topic you care about. Keep up with us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening today. This is All In.